Blog Talk Radio.
You're the light, you're the night, you're the color of my blood. You're the cure, you're the pain, you're the only thing I want to touch.
Welcome to Cultural Conversations with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. Join us as we bring weekly cultural topics right here to our studio. You, as our studio audience, are welcome to chime in and call the studio or join us on chat. Because, you know, at Cultural Conversations, we believe that cultural issues really do shape and impact our world. So, join us as we discuss the hottest topics and the cultural issues of our day. Stay tuned.
Well, welcome to another edition of Cultural Conversations with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. Tonight, our topic is very dear to my heart because it talks about our sense of humanity. It approaches and addresses our sense of humanity as human, our dignity, how we treat our fellow humans. And so it was very important for me to address this issue on Cultural Conversations. And the topic is police killing black men in America. Who can stop the madness? And it seems as though not a half day goes by where on social media you will see a clip of a police officer who is actually hired by the community, hired by the city to protect citizens and the community from bad people, I'm going to say, that we see these clips on social media and on television, on the media, where there's a abuse of power or a shooting or some unexplained, I'm going to say, coincidence, or it seems like now it's just a trend where for the smallest infractions, a black man, if they're black and male, they will be shot. It will be lethal force against them. So I wanted to address this issue tonight, and we're going to take our time and talk about this. I think it's important for the community to talk about it. I think whether you're black, white, red, green, purple, yellow, whatever your ethnicity and your racial background is, I think it affects all of us. And it's important to talk about these issues. Again, you're listening to or tuning in to Cultural Conversations with your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. If you would like to call in our show, we have a guest tonight. You can call in our show and you can talk to our guest or voice your opinion. Please do. You can call into the show at 347-857-3121. Again, the call-in number is 347-857-3121. Tonight, our topic is police killing black men in America. Who can stop the madness? And again, it seems as though a half a day doesn't pass where we will get clips, social media clips, of some citizens taping or recording on their cell phone or other device police officers who are hired to protect us and have a good relationship with all the community, each community, that there'll be an abuse of power. And so we want to address this. Also, we want to just send condolences out to individuals who have been impacted, their families have been impacted by things that have happened with police officers and in the community, in our community, in other communities. And so our guest tonight, I've known our guest, very prolific speaker and community organizers, And someone said, oh, yeah, I got to tune in because Mel has been in the business for a while and he knows what he's talking about. And I'm telling you, when I met Mel Reeves a couple of years ago, I thought I was a pretty hot community organizer, and he put me to shame. He knew what he was doing. And you know what? The thing is, he not only talked the talk, he walked the walk, because I think he was going to Florida when I talked to him a couple of years ago. So he was doing his thing not only here in the Midwest, but he was going down south, which is a very, very tough community to organize down south. But I'm excited to have him on the show. I welcome political activist, community organizer, and social agitator and educator. I put that agitator and educator on there. Mel Reeves to the show. Mel has traveled throughout the country in organizing and bringing attention to the social ills impacting the Black community and addressing police brutality in Minneapolis and other major cities. Mel he will give us his perspective of the rash outbreak of police shootings that have resulted in Black men being senselessly shot dead at the hands of law enforcement. So we will talk about possible solutions to eliminate the targeting and killing of Black men in America. And I never would have thought, like 2015, that we would see, you know, instead of being lynched by ropes and trees, it's almost a lynching by guns. It's just sad. And again, my condolences go out to all the families that have been impacted, and there's many, many families that have been impacted by this just rash of tragedy. I don't know what else to call it. And maybe Mel, when we get him on the line in a few seconds, he can kind of explain what's really going on here. Again, you're listening to Cultural Conversations. Me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. If you would like to call in to the show, please do. We will have a little extension of our show today, so we'll have more time to do more things. Call into the show. You can call in at 347-857-3121. Again, that number is 347-857-3121, and I hope to hear you soon on the line and see what we'll talk about. But for right now, we're going to get Mel on the line, and we're going to start our interview with Mel. Mel, welcome.
Yes, I'm here.
To Cultural Conversations. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I like that introduction. I really like that piece where you called me an agitator/educator because, you know, I'm old school, and us old schoolers remember we need to keep this in our community. You don't have to have a PhD to teach folks stuff.
Right.
You really don't. And most of the actors, you know, we learn through reading, through experience, through analyzing. And so I'm glad you called me an educator because that's what I try to do with young people. I have a young group of folks that study with me on occasion. It's kind of loose. We say a loose group of young folks because, you know, sometimes it gets to be too much for them, I think. Yes, I appreciate you calling me an educator because that would be accurate as well.
Yeah, you know, I'm from old school too, and I grew up down south. And I grew up listening to my parents and my grandparents talk about civil rights and what they had to march and go on the back door of the bus and go on the back and then walk up to the front to pay and then get back out and then come back in again. It was just some kind of elaborate thing that they had to do. But one of the things that I remember is my dad having these records, these big records that you would put on, like a LP, I don't know what you call them. It was a big album. And he would put them on and it would be Dr. King's speeches. And one of the speeches that just rung, really stayed in my head was, he said, we have to sometimes be agitators in the community. And I was like, an agitator? Agitator is something that's bad, right? Well, I learned that agitators are good and they serve a purpose and they stir the pot because sometimes the pot just gets stucky and stale. And that's what we're seeing in the Black community with the shooting of black men. So, Mel, could you give our listening audience some of your background? Who are you, and what do you bring to the conversation tonight?
You laid it out pretty well. I've been doing political activism about 30 years, give or take, probably a little more than 30 years. I have a pretty interesting journey. I started off in Miami, and, when I grew up, still a little bit, it was a kind of segregated neighborhood. So I went to integrated high school, and Miami was kind of in a bubble, at least where I lived. You know, I don't remember people talking politics much in high school, because we were right in the middle of a lot of stuff going on in the world. But there wasn't a lot of conversation about it, oddly enough. And I remember when I did start to become more conscious, I look back on it and go, well, why didn't we? And I think because on some level we lived pretty decent lives, even though I was poor. I lived in a segregated community. You know, we had everything that we needed, you know, and we had a little bit of everybody there. So it was self-contained. I accepted a call to the ministry when I was young and maybe decided I wanted to go off to college. I went to Bible college, which was gave me an education in itself. You know, I went to school with some white Christians who, I'm not exaggerating, who were surprised to find out there were black folks who were Christians. They had some real wild attitudes, some of them did. And it was quite the environment. Though there were a lot of good people there as well, but it was quite an environment. So I left after a year and a half, couldn't take it anymore, so I wound up doing community college stuff. And I wrote a paper. I'll never forget this. I wrote a paper for by Jewish professor Mark. I can't think of Mark's last name right now, but I wrote a paper about the death penalty. And in the death penalty, back then I was conservative. You know, a lot of black people, you know, grew up in the church, we were conservative. Don't ask me why we were so conservative, because our theology did not fit our sociology. And so that was my perspective. And so I had an Old Testament reading of the Bible that was real archaic. And so I wrote this piece about the death penalty and why it was justified. And my professor, Mark, gave me back my paper and said, well, I'm not going to grade this. And, you know, I was a pretty good student, so I was like, man, I did my research. Why aren't you going to break? This is my opinion. And so Professor Mark said to me, I'll never forget it, he said, man, you can't have that opinion and be black, too. It was pretty arrogant, and so I was pretty mad at him. But he gave me this book called Go to Prison, the Poor Go to Prison and the Rich Get Off, I think it was called, or The Rich Get Off and the Poor Get to Prison. I'll never forget it. And I read that thing from cover to cover, and I wrote another paper and talked about why the death penalty was a problem for black folks. And that was the beginning of my awakening. It really was. And I went off to a little Christian college, believe it or not, in Iowa, because they had some scholarships. That's a long story. People always ask, how did you go to Iowa from Miami? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was a poor boy, and if you had some scholarship money, I was coming. So that's how I wound up there. And, you know, it was a Christian college. I wanted to stay in the Christian milieu. I was trying to do the preacher thing. And got a great education there. And, of course, I got a sociological education there as well. You know, I had some interesting experiences with some of my white classmates. But I took a lot of leadership there, and that helped politicize me, because most of my classmates figured, for their reason, that I had some leadership skills, so they nominated me to head up what we just, our newly formed Black Student Union, all of like 25 students. So, but we raised some hell and had a good time. And so then I came to Minnesota to work at Park Avenue. They used to have a summer program because I was doing youth work. I thought maybe I'd do youth ministry. You know, I had gotten a little politicized. I thought maybe I want to do some social justice stuff. So I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I did a lot of youth work. In fact, some young people in the community know me as their coach. I coached a lot of basketball and football. Wasn't too bad at it. I coached folks. I took people camping. So there's a bunch of young folks who knew me who aren't so young anymore. They knew me as a camp counselor or took camping or coaching. So I did that for a bit. And I still had this consciousness in my back of my mind. And I was trying to work out the little consciousness I had by working with young people. And I realized that I wasn't really making much headway, you know. And so as I began to study and pay attention to things, I realized that this problem was deeper. And at right about that time, I was kind of tired of the youth thing. One of my friends said, man, why are you doing youth ministry? You got so much to offer. kind of thought it was an arrogant thing for him to say. He's like, because, you know, this is what I want to do. But, you know, he was paying me a compliment. He's like, brother, you know, you was the sharpest cat in school. You still do new stuff. I go, well, yeah, I like it. And so that was on my mind. I wound up taking a job with it's a defunct organization now called Clergy and Laity Concern. And I did the racial justice thing. And just doing that work really radicalized and politicized me. And that really began to open my eyes to what was really going on. I began to read, study, and travel to different, this is, you know, like the late 80s, early 90s, and I began to travel and, you know, see what was going on around the world. So that radicalized me, and I began to just work on whatever popped up, you know, just started doing it. And then I began to write more, and I took a job with the Minnesota Sportsman Report as the editor. So that, you know, allowed me to kind of radicalize other people, because I don't know if anybody remembers the progression of the Spokesman Reporter, but early on it used to be just kind of this paper that talked about, you know, the social events or whatever, and we turned it to a serious paper that was reporting on everything that was going on.
You talk about travel, and I know a couple of months ago, maybe about a year ago now, you had a very heavy push on traveling around the country, looking at policing, community policing, and I don't even want to say community policing. You were seriously on a mission in Ferguson, okay? You were seriously
right
on that mission. You were sending out notifications. You were going. You were sending out updates, and you still are sending out updates. What is going on in our communities? What is going on in our country where we're seeing a rash of black men that are being hunted? I mean, it just feels like they're being hunted on the streets. What
mm-hmm.
what is your assessment? Because I'm trying to make sense of it.
And to finish my little bio thing, it was a police brutality thing that really woke me up. In fact, I could murder Tysel Nelson here. Me and some other folks, including Keith Ellison, believe it or not, were doing that work. But it you know, it serves to wake you. So what's going on? Like somebody said the other day very well, they said that this isn't new. We're just seeing film of it now. But that's absolutely true. They've been shooting us down and brutalizing us in our community for years. Think about it. You can get anybody from anywhere. They can tell you stories about brutality on behalf of the police. You name the generation. Generation X's, the millennium, you know what I'm saying, the baby boomers, everybody, our generation. Everybody has a story to tell. Everybody can tell you about being pulled over for next to nothing, or, you know, being harassed or hassled for next to nothing. So this is part of the American fabric. So what's going on now is that they have a problem because their inventions have caught up with them. You know, we have something now called video that's causing them some problems, because now we can see for ourselves. And it's good, because it's making people who want to hold on to their racism, it's making them real nervous. It's making them real nervous, because it's hard to hold on to it. And you keep seeing these films of, you want to believe it, well, black people are just bad. And then you see people just killing folks. You know, you got to go, oh, okay, there's something else going on here. So the police brutality issue is one that we're going to have with us. And you know where I'm coming from. So, you know, I have a real radical perspective on this thing. I think it's systemic. And so as long as we have the social, political, economic system, we know it's capitalism, in place, we're going to have police brutality, police violence. Because they need the police, because they need the police, especially when times get hard, you know, because when times get hard, you know, folks, desperate people start to do desperate things, you know. That's what keeps folks from breaking. Let's face it, if there were no police, would folks pay for everything in the store?
No, they would.
You know what I'm saying? Would somebody come in and decide they're going to make a bank loan
without going to the bank officer? I understand the whole makeup of needing a society based in rules, or, you know, some kind of standard of conduct, code of conduct, things of that. But it almost seems in its very makeup, in its very design, and I haven't done a lot of research, historical research. I'm always looking at the historical patterns. When we started developing our black communities, neighborhoods, our enclaves, our caucuses, I'm going to say, when we went into our hood, per se, when did it become a norm for that community or a community to be policed by some other race that looks different than the race that they're policing. I'm just confused. And it seems like it just happened overnight. Like a whole white police force, maybe a sprinkle of black people, one, two here, but they're policing a community, all African-American community. When did that happen, or did it always exist?
Well, you know? we had a time when it was the police force were primarily white. And then after the Civil Rights Movement, in a lot of places, police forces where the city was predominantly black, that like you saw it, and you really see it down south in Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia, a lot of smaller towns have predominantly black police forces. And just like you find in some small rural towns that would have less than 5,000, 10,000 folks, you see that the policing there is a little humane. A little more humane. And what's going on there is that, right, there's a sense of identification with one another, right? But don't misunderstand, they are going to carry out the law, you know, to the best. You know, they're not going to give up, you know, they ain't giving up anything. But they're a little more humane because they do have a little more identity with the community. So, but in our communities, most of the police were white, and most of our communities. Now that's changed over. But as you see, places like D.C. and New York, I think it was D.C. at one point, they had, you know, the D.C. police department was like 80%, 85% black. It had one of the highest percentages of police brutality in the country, which dispels the whole idea that, you know, if you put black folks in a uniform, they're going to act differently. Now, it's possible, and let me get a little deep into that, which is why the real solution to policing is community control. So if you have a more just society, right, where people don't have this need to flex their muscle, to reinforce racist stereotypes, to reinforce class relations, then you have people operating with each other like human beings. You see what I'm saying? All police should be there for is to kind of keep people from getting out of pocket, you know, going too far here or there. But because we live in an unjust society, we got all this extra criminality anyway because, you know, of the exploitation and the unequal distribution of the resources. So folks don't have stuff, they're going to take it. You know what I'm saying? The people at the top, that's what they do. You know, they make that even legal. And so that's what we're dealing with. So on one hand, if you have a black community, you have all black police force, there's an opportunity there sometimes, but not all the time. Sometimes a black cop puts on that uniform, he'll tell you, look, when I put the uniform on, I'm blue. You know, I'm a part of this system, and I'm going to carry out the rules and whatever. And then you add to that, some of these cats that put these uniforms on are filled with self-hatred. I've seen that. Some of these guys don't like black people, just as some of their racist partners. They share that in common. Yes, they do, in some departments, yes, sir. So that's why it didn't work. That's why our solution, so the overall solution right now is not black cops or women cops. The solution is a more just system in which we can have just policing spring from it, you know. And so what we have to push for is, you know, stopgap measures. So I'm down for pushing for civilian review, but I call for community control. And they go, well, we'll never get community control. Well, we won't get it if you don't ask for it. You know, I know what I'm doing when I'm asking for it. I'm trying to get you to think, well, we can't really have community control of the police unless we have a more just society. Bingo. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, unless we have a society that's not exploitative and, you know, that kind of thing. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
We have a caller in. And I'm excited that we have a caller in. Caller from 845, you have a question or a comment?
I just had a comment to make. I think one of the reasons, because I was watching this documentary on television. I mean, actually, it was on YouTube, to be honest with you. It was on YouTube. And it was talking about how the news media, how they set up their whole system. And one of the reason why I'm bringing this up is because people fail to realize there's a huge brainwashing going on through media, through what we read in the magazines, through the TV, and on a regular basis. And one of the reasons why, what I noticed about this documentary was the lady, the host, basically the lady who ran the whole TV show. Like, she was a newscast. She was like the director. She basically said, like, she gave an example. She said, if you had a white teenager who goes into a predominantly affluent neighborhood, and let's say he did the same thing as that young black male did, they said they would primarily focus more on the young black male because for some reason fear drives rating. And the biggest fear that white America has, of course, is a young black man entering a predominantly white neighborhood and violating some innocent white person. So part of the reason why there's so much, I think, animosity towards black men, you have to understand, a lot of these white officers, they're being brainwashed on a regular basis to fear black men. So any sudden move from that black man, a lot of it is fear, anxiety, and the fact that they're brainwashed through the media. Because if you watch TV enough, I'll be honest with you, you really start to think all black men do is just crimes. You really start to think that. And when that lady said that on it, in the documentary, that basically the main reason why they would pick a black male committed a crime over a white male is because it brought in more ratings because of the fear factor, because it fed into that fear within the white people's psyche. It just shows you at the end of the day, the media has a lot to do with this because they're brainwashing to let the public know at mass that all these black men are nothing but criminals. And these police officers are being brainwashed to believe the same way.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank you very much for your comment. And you know what, the caller who called in, you must have read my notes because that was my next question for Mel, is that, what's the big fear of black men? I mean, Nicola read my notes. I don't know how. But I want to know, what is this big fear of black men? Because even on the clips, and I've watched these clips, I got to stop watching these police clips. I've watched them over and over and over. And I said, this police officer, yeah, he's big and bad, and he's boasting up. He's trying to put his like, cool pose on to try to intimidate. He's trying to put an intimidation polls on, but you can tell it's based in fear. So what is the fear from historical point? What is the fear of black men?
Well, you know, there's a guy on YouTube now. He's calling himself Dixon White. I don't know if anybody's seen it. It's pretty good. Everybody should go look at him. He says he's old redneck. And he said he's a former racist, and he was talking about, you know, I don't know if he said why he stopped being racist, but anyway, he realized he didn't want to be racist anymore. So he's having this really honest conversation with people. It's like brutally honest, and he says that he thinks that the reason that white people on some level are even racist, he says, because they have a fear that black people are going to do to them what was done to that, what white people would historically have done to them. And I think there's some truth to that. But I think that the fear-mongering going along is part of white supremacy. White supremacists wanting to perpetrate black people as the other, as dangerous. All of that as far as the white supremacist efforts to paint us in a negative light. Look at these shootings, like when Darren Wilson murdered Mike Brown, he was able to say, and with a straight face, you know, to an American public, that look, this guy was menacing. Now, he's got a gun. He's 6'4". You think about how crazy that is when you think about it. But that was the height of white supremacy, and you're getting it again now because of what they're subtly inferring, because they're trying to figure out how to deal with all these police killings. And what they kind of have been inferring very subtly is that, well, you know, even when the brother run, he's dangerous. You know what I'm saying? No matter what he does, he's big and black, he's dangerous. Black people are dangerous, meaning that they're criminal. So that's why they show the pictures, this whole idea of showing people's pictures and all that. All it does is reinforce the idea of black otherness. Blacks are dangerous. Blacks are bad. It's a setup. It's a setup to the system of white supremacy. And you're right. The press is one of the ways they inject white supremacy. The press, their education system, you name it, their entertainment. Every aspect of U.S. society is geared to reinforce white supremacy, whereas the political gears are set up to reinforce capitalism, and the economic gears are set up to reinforce, you know, the making of the money. But the social piece is the white supremacy thing, which keeps us divided. Because if we start all catching the same hell, we can't come together, then, you know, the man gets to laugh all the way to the bank, you know, while we're trying to figure out, you know, how we should work together when we're both getting exploited. At the end of the day, when you take away racism, we're all, you know, if you ain't rich, you know, unless you're making lots and lots of money, you know, you really don't have that much coming in this society. You can lose your job tomorrow. you know, most places.
Yeah.
You know, so, so yeah, so he's right.
I was about to say, you know, with the media and the media input to hype up black men as these animals, and they have to be watched at all costs. I think that even after Reconstruction, here in the United States or in America, that they were the law enforcement and the policing of communities was designed to say, who is our major threat to society? And black men were labeled as a major threat to all society. And now you have young and old police officers, the old ones are reinforcing the kind of system that you talked about, Mel, that says you got to watch them. They're dangerous. And we got to all keep them contained in their communities or regulate or supervise them in their communities. And it's so obvious that they fear. And some of our police officers, I don't know the percentage, but are coming back from tours of duty
right.
in Afghanistan.
Yes.
And Iraq. They're coming back with that mindset and that kind of soldier mentality.
Right.
American soldier mentality, and they're enforcing it here in our intimate communities. Now, you travel to Ferguson, and also I'm pretty sure you're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in Tulsa. But I think where it came up on my radar when I was little, you know, seeing police barge in, beat the hell out of people, and then leave, you know, or take all their drugs
yep.
or take their money or whatever they had to take, rape people in the community, and then they would just be up and leave. And so I always had a fear of police officers. Even when I had the workshop with cops, with the kids and stuff, there was this underlying, we're not ever friends. Don't smile at me, because I've seen what you've done in communities when I was a little girl. And so just having that, what are you seeing? What did you see in Ferguson? And even with Trayvon Martin, I'll never forget Trayvon Martin. What are we seeing here?
Well, the same thing. We talked about it earlier, though, Verona. We covered that on some level, in the sense that what you're seeing is that they're saying that black people are, you know, we're just inherently criminal. We're inherently dangerous. That's why Trayvon gets killed by George Zimmerman, even though George has the gun. Right? The same thing.
Right.
George has a gun, but Trayvon is seen as dangerous. It's insanity. What you're seeing is a form of insanity that's been perpetrated against on the American people. And when they wake up, I think a lot of people, and you can see it a little bit, some white people are getting mad because they realize, man, we've been had. They don't trick us.
Right.
They tricked us into seeing our problem as black people rather than rich white people. See, everybody's problem is the 1%,
mm-hmm.
those rich, filthy rich white people in power. Those people are our problem. And they'll use people of color as figureheads, by the way, so that confuses
mm-hmm.
people too. But I ain't going there, but, you know, that confuses people too.
Right.
But those people are our problem. And so white people have been tricked. You see when they wake up and realize, man, I've been tricked. It's like Malcolm said, you know, we've been hoodwinked. We've been took. You know, the same thing is still as true white folks. They've been tricked. And then we've been tricked too, because now these last few generations, they don't read their history anymore. So black people don't know anything about
mm-hmm.
slavery. So white racists can just throw out, well, you was a slave, get over it. It's like, dude, it wasn't that simple. You know what I'm saying? You know, people were being raped every day. You were being whipped. You had to work from sunup to sundown. If you didn't meet the quota, you were beat down. Your family was separated right in front of you. Your wife was raped by the man. If he felt like it, if somebody felt like taking something that you had, imagine living that kind of life where nothing you had was secure and that you were always in fear that somebody might do something to you. You know, it's like being constantly bullied. That's slavery. It's not like, oh, well, y'all just a no-no, brother. This was one of the most oppressive systems known to human beings. It's one of the, you know, and so we don't even know our history. So anyway, getting back to your thing. So in Ferguson, what needed to happen, that you mentioned Ferguson, and you see it did not happen.
Mm-hmm.
They had an opportunity, and the young people wanted to do it. This is a thing for another show, but and a lot of people don't disagree. But let me tell you something. If you keep doing the same thing over and over, it doesn't work. You know it's time to do something else. What they say, if you keep trying to do the same thing, insanity is, you know, doing the same thing, expecting different results. Well, it's insane
mm-hmm.
for us as black people to keep going to the polls and voting for people who have already demonstrated that I'm not really interested, dude. I'm not going to do your bidding. So we don't have nothing else to lose. And Ferguson, the young people were down for this, but they sent all them Democratic operatives down there, because even Keith Ellison said he was down there, which I said they got my attention. Why was Keith Ellison in Ferguson? Because the democracy, the system, let me tell you something, this system is pretty slick. The last thing they want you to do is recognize that the system is a problem. So they'll do all kind of stuff to keep you from stepping outside of it. Because the most freeing thing you can do is step outside of it. Try it. Break away from the Democratic Party and see how much better you feel. Because you know in your heart that these people ain't getting it done. Break away from both of them. And so in Ferguson, the move was they had these council seats available. What was supposed to happen, I was preaching it when I was there, me and some of the other radicals and revolutionaries were saying, look, man, organize the community. Get a call to a big town call meeting and say, here are our top 10 priorities. And then out of that, have a few meetings. The people you trust. Don't have them like the guy who won one to see. He's an ex-prosecutor. He's a cat that came in and said, vote for me, I'll set you free. It's the same old crap. You know, he might do some good stuff, no doubt, Verona, but you needed a regular grassroots Fannie Lou Hamer type, you see what I'm saying, a Diane Nash type, you see what I'm saying, who's just somebody who's living in the community, who has the best interest of the community art, and you push them forward, you go register people to vote, and they said that, you know, only 30% of folks registered to vote. Part of that was because they didn't have any confidence. What they're saying is what should have happened was folks should have registered them to vote independent. You see what I'm saying? They could have started their own little independent party. Call it the Ferguson Feel Good Party. You know, whatever you want to call it. You know what I'm saying? The new party in front, whatever you want to call it. But have your own platform. This is what we want to see happen. They could have taken over the police, and they could have, in the U.S., we could have had the example of Ferguson as the way that municipal courts were supposed to be run, how the police, they could have been a shining example, but the interlopers, the folks who work for this system were down there trying to keep them people from doing something different. Because I was there, and them kids wanted to do something different and radical. But we had a chance Ferguson had a chance to be on the map as the first municipality that just went independent, that took their own lives into their own hands. And you know what I'm saying? Took their own lives into their own hands and did what was best for them. Without any compromise, they had a chance to do that. And the reason they didn't do it, because all these Democratic Party operatives and all these hustlers and opportunists were down there in droves, and the FBI and all kind of folks, trying to keep them young people from putting into practice what the radicals and forward-thinking people were saying. I'm going to write about it at some point. I'm going to go down and do an investigation. I wasn't there for all of it, but you'll see.
You were there for a lot, and you wrote about it, and you kept us updated. Mel, hold on one moment. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back because we have a caller that's on the line that would like to make a comment, and so I want to capture that caller before our time is up here. But you're listening to Cultural Conversations. Tonight's topic is police killing men in America. Who can stop the madness? And we're looking at it from a historical point, our engagement with police officers in communities of color. What historically have that been? How did they get in communities of color? Why not have a police force from the community of color or have a mixed police force? And Mel, kind of updating me and giving me some education about it's not about the person's color of the skin. Maybe it's the color of the uniform. If it's all blue, they're living by the blue code and not necessarily connecting with humanity in the community. And so we're getting an education tonight. You're listening to Cultural Conversations, and this is going to be a two-part series. So Mel is going to come. He's talking about what's happening on the ground because he's visiting different cities that this is going on. And then later on we'll have another speaker that comes in and talk about some of the solutions as well next week. But we're listening to Mel Reeves here on Cultural Conversations. Mel has traveled throughout the country organizing and bringing attention to social ills impacting the Black community and addressing police brutality in Minneapolis and other major cities. Mel comes to give us his perspective of the rash outbreak a recent outbreak of police shootings that have resulted in black men being senselessly shot dead at the hands of law enforcement. So we are talking about possible solutions to eliminate the targeting and killing of black. And in the first session, we talked about, our caller called in and said it's about fear. It's much about fear, that they have this fear. It's hyped up by the media and the imagery of black men. And black men feed into that kind of tough guy pose or whatever. And I'm not a black man. I don't know what goes on in the psyche of a man. I wish I did. I'd probably make $1 million writing that book. But I don't know what goes on in that psyche. But all I know is to see the image of Mr. Scott running away, running. And he wasn't running that fast. He wasn't running to the police officer. He was running away. And it's the older guy running away from whatever he thinks is going to happen. And seeing this police officer stand tough and brace himself, plant his feet on the ground, put both hands on his revolver. I mean, really getting a good brace. That's called getting a good stance and a good brace. And firing that many times, not firing at Mr. Scott's legs to stop him from running. He wasn't intending to stop. His intention was to kill. And that's the image that keeps going in my mind. You're listening to Cultural Conversations with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. If you would like to get in on this conversation, please call the show at 347-857-3121. We're having a cultural conversation with Mel Reeves, and I'm also putting my spin on it. And I'm going to get my second caller here on the line. Caller, you are on the line with Cultural Conversations. Thank you for calling.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing fine.
This is Bianchi calling from St. Louis area.
Okay.
You know, on this issue, now, I don't know much about it. I think you said Minneapolis. Of course, New York and Chicago are cases of their own big cities like that. But in municipalities like your North Charleston, of course, Ferguson, which, you know, I live near, blacks already have the power to stop police officers from shooting them. Why do they think that they need somebody else? Police, as I said, I think I was on your show once before, and I keep reiterating this, but it seems like people don't want to believe it. Police are merely employees of a municipality.
Yeah.
And they have to, first they swear, they take an oath to the Constitution and the state Constitution and also to the ordinance and laws of the municipality that they work for. The municipality is their boss. The municipality has a say on how they go about using deadly force, and they have to do it that way. And during all the burning and the rioting and the protests, you had at least four different separate issues going on there. The National Guard didn't shoot anybody. Matter of fact, the police was told not to shoot anybody. That's because the politicians told them not to. In Jennings, in Velda Village, Velda City, they dissolved their police department. And they contract with St. Louis County until at some time they have a pool of applicants, and then they could bring their own police department back. So it's just that simple. And then again, maybe it's not. The gentleman that killed, the officer that killed Scott, I don't know what South Carolina's laws are, but if that had been in Missouri, the police officer would walk free because the law permits them to do that. Supreme Court decision, Tennessee Gardner, if a suspect is under arrest and he tries to elude that arrest, the police officer can use whatever means necessary in order to, you know, effect a control over them, including deadly force and shooting in the back, because he perceives that that individual would run and maybe take a hostage or do harm to another citizen. So change the laws. Blacks have the ability to do that. Not every place, but, you know, in a lot of places is where it needs to be done.
Well, can I speak to that? Well, that sounds good, my brother. Actually, what they've done is they have changed the law. They've changed the law to make it easier for the police to shoot folks. So we won't change the law. The Supreme Court actually does not. Hello?
Yeah, what city, what black municipality changed the law so police can more easily shoot their children?
Oh, no, the Supreme Court. Like you just said, and, like you pointed out in Missouri, there was there have been some rulings that have, because people got shot in the back and it's gone all the way to the Supreme Court. And there's been rulings that, like you said, in Missouri.
Tennessee versus Gardner. Tennessee versus Gardner. The Supreme Court merely said that the police acted in the way the law of Tennessee gave him the permission to law to act.
Right.
That's all that said. It didn't say that they could do it. It was the father of the kid that got killed took the argument to the Supreme Court about that he didn't pose any harm. But the Supreme Court said, well, the way the law is written in the state that defines deadly force, what he done was all right.
Right. So if I can interrupt for a second, because we can go round and round about the legal thing. So, as I pointed out earlier, my brother, this is systemic. And so they could tomorrow change the laws so they would make it much more difficult for police to shoot you and get away with it. Now, even when the law seems to be more favorable, they still sometimes will still use it to say, well, his life was threatened. So the bottom line is this. In a just society in which the citizens were being killed, there would be some real reaction to that. We would move to stop it. But in our society, which is not a just society, which is set up around the exploitation of folks' labor for the most part, and the exploitation of wealth here and around the world, then they need the police department to keep you in check. And so that's why the government never makes any move. There's been no Supreme Court ruling, nothing to pretty much say, hey, you've got to respect the right of the citizen. And that's not going to happen. We can sit and debate it all we want. Now, it could happen when enough people decide we've had enough of this. We change the way Congress looks and what have you. But at this point, there's nothing. The Supreme Court doesn't have any real reason to change any laws to say that, you know, you just can't shoot somebody. I don't care what the situation is. Because most of the laws in almost every, in all over the country, gives the cops the benefit of the doubt. The only reason this guy in North Charleston is going to go to jail is because everybody saw it. Okay, everybody saw it and him killed in cold blood. And that doesn't mean he's going to be convicted. We saw Rodney King almost got beat half to death on camera. And they were saying somehow his body was jumping up and resisting him every time the blow hit him. You know, it's real craziness because they don't want to convict these people. This is why I say it's part and parcel of the system. Me and you will have beers down to the floor and still be debating it as long as this system is in place, my brother. They're going to always allow for them to kill us because the police play a very important role for them. That's why they don't change this. Think about it. All this stuff has come out, and the FBI, the federal government, Department of Justice has not said, hey, we're going to come out with a unilateral ruling. If you shoot and kill somebody, we're going to put you on trial. But Mel,
that's a state's issue. And rich and
wealthy
issue, blacks.
No,
it's not.
It's a federal issue.
Well, I'm here in Ferguson. Let me tell you what it is 5 minutes from me. Let me tell you what it is 5 minutes from me. It's a state issue. Now, I don't know what it is in Minnesota where you live. I don't know what it is in New York, but here in Missouri, it's a state issue. And we have rich and wealthy blacks which stay about 5 miles from Ferguson, who also is protected by the police, except they got in their community, they have their own police department, should I say. The police is not going to stop shooting your kids if they got the right to do so. You can talk about morals. Well, wait a minute. We can talk about morals. We can talk about humanity. We can talk about ethics and all that stuff. They are not going to stop doing it if they got the right and the law is backing them to do it. Change the law.
Okay. I pretty much said what I thought about it. I agree. They're definitely not moral. It's not about morality. They're not going to change the law because they don't have an interest in changing the law. But you make one good point you do make. In your state, if enough force, enough pressure is brought to bear, they may change the law, but they're not going to do it without any pressure being brought to bear.
In my municipality, my municipality right here, if the board tell the chief of police and they put it in writing, make it policy, that you don't do this under these circumstances, they don't do it. And if they do it, they get fired and also face prosecution. It's simple.
And that's also true. Yes, and that's also true. In some municipalities, it's a very good point, my brother. You know, there are exceptions to the rule. In some municipalities, because a few years ago, somebody, the guy who had the accident in North Carolina, and he was knocking on doors, a black guy, and the woman called the police, and the cop rolled up and shot him. Well,
I remember that one. You're absolutely right.
The department there fired him right away. They fired him. He was, I don't know what happened with his case, but he was charged. But the guy who ran the department was pretty innocent. He took a no-nonsense approach. He didn't even stop to look at all the facts and all that stuff. Like, you know, they were trying to say, man, hold off and take a look. He said, no. You know, from what I've seen, there's nothing that tells me that what he did, he should have done. This was the old southern kind of semi-redneck cat. But he said, we're not going to do this. And he fired you right off the bat. And you're right. So you're right.
That's because
people
the chief
do
of
have
police,
the ability to do the right thing.
Yeah, the chief of police have the right to make the policy. The state legislature passed the bill into a statute, and the statute applies to law enforcement. Each police department in that whole state, the head of that department can look at that statute and interpret it however they think it means. And thus, they make rules and regulations based on what he thinks the statute is saying. Now, like in Tennessee, the man who lost his son challenged the statute. And it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said the statute is clear. What the police officer done was per the statute. So that's how those things come about. The use of deadly force is very broad. It's very vague. It's not specific. That's why you get so many different rules which produce these different results. Unless the law is very specific and say you can only do this when this happened, or you can only do that when that has happened, and then you're going to continue to get these crazy results the way people are complaining, which I think is really, it's just a shame. But until people change the law, blacks in their own small municipality change the law. Tell your police officer, look, you're not going to do this. You know what? You can make them go back to six shooters. You don't have to. They don't have to. You don't. If you don't want them to use 9mm, you want them to go back to using six shooters, they got to do it. If not, guess what? They get fired and hire somebody else.
And if you were listening to me earlier, I was making that point about Ferguson. If Ferguson had controlled the city council, then they could have determined what kind of policing and what kind of police force they were going to have. So I was making that point. But both things are true at the same time. The laws are set up to allow these guys to get away with it. Ferguson could have changed it. Now, what they would probably have done, if there's enough Ferguson that springs up, you know how these guys are, they would figure out a way to counter whatever the local folks are doing.
We can do the same thing.
They
want
to keep this, yeah.
You can do the same thing. Take the ability to hire away from the chief of police. Take the ability to hire away from the fire captain. Have a central location where your local applications are. When time comes for a new employee, you go to that central location and you pull from that pool. You do not let them get on the phone and use the good old boy system.
Right. But ultimately the laws have to be changed, but ultimately the system is going to have to be changed, because the laws can be as you want. They can be interpreted a lot of different ways. Sometimes you think of the laws, and then they figure out a way to interpret it. Like, for example, in the right to be free from the Fourth Amendment, the right to be free from
illegal searches,
harassment, and that kind of stuff. They applied in the 1800s. The slaveholders applied that to them. You know, the right to have your property, nobody mess with your property. They applied that to whenever the states tried to interfere with what they did with the slaves. They sure did. They applied that Fourth Amendment. Sure did.
it brings the issue of the Fourth Amendment, and seizure comes into existence. And, you know, the court says they got a right to use the ability to seize you, where they are not violating the Fourth Amendment when they shoot you, when they shoot you in the back. They actually, what they're doing, they're seizing you. They're stopping you from going anyplace else. That's why I come when a cop, there's certain things that you should teach your children to say. And one thing, you should teach them not to answer questions. You should ask them, am I being detained? If he says no, then you say that you're leaving. They have no right to detain you unless they have a reason, like they're investigating. In a case in South Carolina, when he told the man to stay in his car, he was investigating him because he was running his tags. If you get up and run in the midst of an investigation, they got a right to consider whatever they want to, whether they can think that, you know, and nobody knows the perception of an individual. A danger that's perceived to you may not be a danger in my perception. So nobody can say, well, the man was running away. He didn't pose to be a danger. Well, you don't know what that was going on in that officer's mind. You know what, Mel? I've seen a white police woman physically chase a brother, pull out a taser, shot at him, and, you know, you could hear that. So he missed him, and she could have pulled a gun out and shot him, but she didn't. So maybe she didn't perceive him as being a trouble. I mean, being a problem for her. But in another case, another one might. So the way to, you know, make sure that this crazy stuff don't go on, just put down rules and regulations in the departments that you control with your tax dollars, that you being a resident in that community, that you a majority political body in that community, and say, look, you can't do this, you can only do that, and vice versa. That's all I wanted to say.
Hello?
Hey, I'm still here. Where's the host?
Yeah.
I am right here.
Rona?
I am right here. So
okay.
I am right here. I have another caller on the line. Actually, that's how I got booted out. I was actually taking another caller from another line and got totally booted out and had to go all the way back in. But I'm glad that you gentlemen was able to carry on the conversation. Felicia, you are on the line with Cultural Conversation. Thanks for holding on. You have a question and comment?
I actually have a comment. Good evening, Verona, and good evening, Mel. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Well, this is my comment. During this entire discussion, we've talked about fear, we've talked about media, we've talked about municipalities, but the one thing, the one ingredient or factor that we haven't even talked about is cultural conditioning. See, and I think that that's also a part of all of what's going on. When you start accepting what other people are telling you or showing you, and you start believing it and you start living it. Now, this is how I feel. This is my view on it. It's so nice to say, oh, well, let's change the law. Or it's so nice to say, yes, let's have a protest and let's say Black Lives Matter. That's real cute. That's really nice. But you know what? It's time to wake up. I do not need to press a button in a little box. I do not need to carry a banner around that says my life matters. If you want people to know that your life matters, then that means that you stand up. You get in their face and you say, you know what, this is not okay with me. No, I'm not
right.
going to let this go on. I have heard
right.
this gentleman talking about change the laws, change the laws. That's easier said than done. It starts with you. When I say cultural conditioning, I'm talking about this image, and they buy into it. Let me use an example, the sagging pants, the what is it to be a thug. When you look at this, when this is fed to you 365 days of the year, 24/7, you're going to start accepting it and believing it. Okay, the cop wants me to fear them because they got this badge or whatever. You know it works both ways here. So I'm going to try to make them fear me. okay, then both of you are being ignorant, because the value of your life does not come from the dictates or the definitions of somebody else or some damn law that tells you this is okay and this is not okay. It comes from you out your mouth saying, this is not okay with me. I'm going to stand up. If I got to go down, stand up. And speaking out, that's exactly what I'm going to do. Because I'm going to say it like Fannie Lou Hammond, and I know you can hear it in my voice. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. I am sick and tired of the excuses that we as a community will make. We still, after all of these years, are not unified enough to understand. You want people to understand your life value, your life has value and it matters, then damn it, show it. You should. I don't need someone else to speak for me. I can do that myself. I don't need a piece of paper to tell me my life matters. I don't need to press a button to let somebody know that my life matters. So it's time to wake up, stop believing in the hype, and take full responsibility and ownership for yourself and for your community. Because guess what? There are others that feel like you. There are others that said, I'm not going to keep doing the same old thing over and over again. It's not working. We need a new strategy. And that's all that I have to say on this subject.
Well, Felicia, I think that you touched on something that's very important, and it's that how, and I know that, you know, laws are important, and, you know, our justice system, or what, just like Mel said, when they had that opportunity in Ferguson really to make a difference, to make a stance and say, you know what, historically we've always sided with our law enforcement. We have to. That's the game. That's the game and that's the pattern. This time, let's do something a little different and gradually start doing some reform. They didn't do that. They didn't do it with Trayvon Martin case. They could have done that with that case, and they didn't. The Justice Department, they kind of just let it go. It'll die down. The hype will die down. But one of the things that you said about Black Lives Matter, yes, Black Lives Matter, but it also matters that Black Lives Matter when the black thug on the corner kills the thug on the corner. That's just life matters. I'm upset at that. And I don't want those images flashed on television or in the media, because that's what makes outer communities, I'm going to say external communities, fear, and it kind of solidifies that racial stereotype of to fear black men. If they can kill their own, then we can kill them with no regard. They can't even press charges against, you know, us for killing them. They're killing their own. So I got you on that point as well. And thank you for bringing that out. Mel, I can hear you typing. You're writing that book as we speak. Mel, what do you have to say about that?
No, I'm glad I'm glad she chimed in, because my man got me caught up in the law thing. And you're right. The very first law is that you can't kill your neighbor.
Right.
You know, so that is the supreme law. And so what they've tried to do, speaking of laws, they interpret it any way they want. They interpret the law so it's okay to kill your neighbor. So, you know, I hear what the brother's saying. He's got part of the truth. But as I keep pointing out to him, we have a system that's bound and determined not to follow the law, you know, especially when it applies to us. And so there are exceptions. He was right. But that is not the answer. That's what I keep trying to point out to him. They will keep figuring out. They change the law. When it doesn't work for them, they change it. Unless you're vigilant, because they're running it. We're not running it. And that's what you. I think when you keep talking about the law, you fail to understand that the law, at the end of the day, is a handmaiden of the 1%. So they're not going to let me or you. In Ferguson, we could have done that. Even in Missouri. But that takes, like the sister said, that takes elbow grease. Not just talking about it. It takes elbow grease. That means that we have to get our behinds up and do something to make that happen. But we'll sit back and talk about it. He's right. If you want to get out there and begin to protest at the state capitol and you're consistent with it, they may say, we're going to have to give these folks something. But that's not what we're going to do. So it sounds good, but it's problematic, because we're not going to do that. and then they'll change the law, and then they won't apply the law. Then they'll change the law, and then they'll reinterpret it. We've seen that before.
Right.
I'm trying to chime up, because that's not the whole answer. That's what I kept trying to say to the brother. I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt that he's partly right. But when you don't run stuff, they have the ability to change the law, not us. And so, you know, we can push. Perfect example. They changed the laws down south, but they still find other ways to discriminate against folks. You know, it ain't blatant no more, right? Now you can go where you want to go, but they can still keep you from getting the job you want to get, right? They can still keep you out of certain things. You know what I'm saying? They changed the law, but they're still discriminating. They changed Jim Crow. They still shooting us down in the street. So the law is not the final answer. Because, you know, it's power. I mean, if you have the power to reinterpret the law, it don't matter what the law is.
We got another caller from 612. Caller from 612, you're on with Cultural Conversations.
Yeah, I just always wondered, and want people's thoughts about this, as a side issue with the DOJ report. I wonder if the citizens of Ferguson can and will file a class action suit with all the different issues that are going on with just the government down there.
I don't know if they have. They should. They should have.
I mean, but do you think that's viable that they should be able to?
I'm not a lawyer, so.
Okay. Well, yeah, I want to put that out there. I hope they look into that. That should be evident. I mean, if the DOJ came back with all this stuff that the police department and the government was doing wrong to the citizens, it would seem to me they should have some kind of a case for a class action suit.
I would think so, too.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Okay.
You know how this goes. And I'm sure they talked about that kind of thing because they actually had the government in this case, you know, helping them out. So
it's very telling that as we round out the end of our show, Mel, here, it's very telling that we have to get things straight in our own communities and value our lives in our own community. Now, that doesn't excuse police beating the hell out of you, and that doesn't excuse them killing you and fearing you. But the image, if we know that image is pushed on the media, then we have to get things controlled in our own community. And then, two, with the killing of Mr. Scott, I'm going to even put Trayvon Martin in there with Mike Brown. How do we, you know, Eric Gardner, how do we come to some type of plea to the justice system, Department of Justice, that no, this cannot happen. And I know you have to stick with the party line. So we know the game, that you're sticking with the party line, but it's time to give up the party line because we need justice. We need clear and real justice. What do you think some of the solutions are, Mel, as we end our hour here?
I think practically, one of the things we have to do is we have to recognize where we are. And so one of the things we're up against is that most of us are still in denial. Malcolm X used to say that, man, you're nothing but ex-slave. On some level, that's our reality, and it's a hard reality. So one of the things, if my practical thing would be this, okay, you don't have to be, as I say to people all the time, you don't have to be Mel Reeves, you don't have to be no radical, no revolutionary, my brother, make a difference in the world. One of our issues is literacy. The young people are not getting educated in schools. If you are part of a church, a social organization, a fraternity, one of the things that's desperately needed is adopt the school. You know, help these kids with their literacy. Help this next generation. Don't let us die off here because, you know, we're getting really class separated. You know, if you're a middle class kid, you got a chance for education. If you're a poor kid, your chances are getting slim, close to slim or none. So adopt a school. Help people with literacy. The other thing is, you know, they're locking our kids up left and right. These are practical things people can do. We have to rebuild the community. Two things to do. Rebuild community and challenge the system at the same time. You're right? So my thing is ultimately the solution is to change the system. But short of that, we don't have to throw our hands up. You can do what you can. Like the brother talked about with the law thing. Now here's an example of what we can do around this law thing to agree with him on some level. But the prosecuting attorneys we found out are the ones who are the reason the jails are filling up. Different places they call them attorney generals, city prosecutors, there's different names for them, but whoever wants to decide who goes to jail, who doesn't, whoever files the charges, what we have to do is, in these general elections, begin to push to get somebody in them offices who won't just lock all our kids. Now, that's a tall order. That means that there's some different things, but it's another idea. The other thing is, write letters to kids that you know are locked up. Don't just leave them locked. When they come out, welcome them. If you're part of a church, get y'all folks together and say, let's welcome these kids back in the community. Embrace them. You don't have to be no radical to do this kind of thing. You know what I'm saying? The third piece is, when something happens in your community, rally around it. When the system, when folks do something to your people, rally around it. There's not any jobs in your community, rally around it. This is nothing new. I ain't that smart. This is stuff we've all done before. You know what I'm saying? And these are things that we need to do again. We have to rebuild our community. So one of the things that happened in the 60s, why people could fight the system so well, because they didn't have to worry about building up the community. Now we got to worry about, we got to start from scratch. And the other thing is, people running around, but people's kids ain't doing this, and they ain't doing. So what are we going to do? Are we just, because the kid's not well raised, we're going to let the kid run out of the street, get run over? We didn't used to operate like that before, because you don't have a good mama. I'm just going to watch him get done in, because his mama ain't telling the street. I'm not going to snatch him out of the street because I could. Really? We're not going to take any responsibility.
Or even, say, hey, you guys, I don't want to be disrespectful, but, it doesn't look good hanging on the corner. It doesn't look good hanging out like this. And, a lot of people fear approaching people or telling people, I'm not trying to be funny. I'm not trying to know you might have a problem or whatever, but, I'm just trying to keep you from getting hurt or I'm trying to keep you from getting killed here. And I've done that to people. I've done that to young people, and the older people acting crazy, like, okay, this is not going to end well. This is not going to end well with you. And so just, kind of putting a buzz in their ear. And some of them appreciate it. Some of them come back and, they cuss you out or whatever. But we all live in a community together. On your bus, and then someone gets shot, and then the whole community wants to rally and do all the marches, but then after a couple of weeks of marches, then you don't hear anything again, and then the cycle just
well, and so part of our condition being specific, we're going to have that vibe because people are always going to see the oppressor in one another. It's almost like it is psychological and scientific. I tell people that all the time. What we do in our community is psychological and scientific. It's what all oppressed folks have done. They ain't got nothing to do with the color of the skin. When the Irish, when the British oppressed the Irish, they acted a fool. They still do. You see it. And then they have the Uncle Toms versus the folks who want to be free. The Protestants versus the Catholics. What that is the people who are okay with British oppression versus the people who want to end it. They don't understand, and they be going at it. There must be violence. And so we're going to have this silence in our community because the system keeps continually telling folks that we aren't anybody. You ain't nobody. You ain't nobody. You ain't nobody. And he ain't nobody. And so it ain't nothing to look at another black person as nobody. And it's in that tough. It's in that extreme. If you ever have a conversation with another black person, you can see it. It's about that hatred. It's like, and you won't see that kind of hatred most of the time when it comes to dealing with white person. Not that, just fool, just gut level. You did something, you said something wrong. You just want to tear my throat out. That comes from our program. And it's what oppressive people do. And that's why you see that. But anyway, getting to finishing your question. So there are things that people can do. There's a little things that you can do because I think our community is falling apart. I think so. We need to help these kids make sure they get education. I think the older folks, got to try to put the arm around the kid every once in a while and say, hey, man, like you said, that's not the way to go. And you can't be just running around just telling them what to do. For example, I was going home. I had a car most of my life. Now I'm in the opposite. I don't have a car because I just didn't want to get another one. I didn't want car payments either. I left the car from Pompton back in 2010 and 9, and that's the teenagers. And I said, I'll get a car again. So anyway, I do a lot of walking. I'm glad I do because it allows me to really get in the community. So I was walking one winter day. It was like the weather had kind of turned earlier.
himself when it was cold. And so this kid was walking with his baby, and the baby didn't have no jacket or gloves on. I'm not kidding. Baby didn't have no gloves on. Barely had a hat on. And he wasn't proper styled, I could tell. But I said to him, brother, because I know he wasn't going to see me well. I said, brother, you got to put some gloves on that child's hands. You got to put better socks on her feet. I'm kind of fussing at him. You got to do better than me, brother. I said, you got to. And so, you know what I did? Now I don't got no money, but I had some money in my pocket. I had $5. And I said, here, brother, I ain't just fussing at you. Here, I'm going to help you to do that. So I gave him $10 to it. And so that's what we have to do, and I don't have no money. So, you know,
right.
I'm not fussing folks, but if you can help them, lend a hand, do that too. And I think he really could appreciate it when I gave him a few dollars to it. He realized, oh, the brother ain't just trying to make me look bad or berate me. He really cares, you know. So that's what we have to do with the young people too, not just talk and talk at them, but do something that shows that, wow, okay. Hey, okay.
Yeah.
We're losing it. The truth be told,
yeah.
We are losing. We
I think caring for. So what are you saying is that caring for our community, owning our community, making our community the best that we can make it, so that when we have external factors that come into our community, whether they're working in collaboration with us in the community or whether they are they're as enforcement. I mean, I'm not saying that police don't have the job to do. You have your job to do, because trust me, if something happens in my house, I want you to be there. I don't want you to be there to beat the hell out of me and confused because of my brown chocolate skin. I want you to be there to serve and protect. And so, you know, they serve a good purpose, but I think it'll be that if you respect our community, you respect each other, then when we are working externally with people, we're not going to let them do whatever they want to do in that community because this is ours. And so I think that's very important. I like the community model that St. Paul has adopted, the community policing model. I like it. I've been on some of the meetings and the tasks. I like that community model where they look at, you know, what's happening in Frogtown, and they had Hmong police officers because that's a Hmong community there. And I'm not saying that those police officers are... They notice that our community looks like this, and representatives of that police force need, some of them need to look like the community, and they and their culture.
Without question. And so, we don't always do. Sometimes it don't.
Right.
Sometimes the black officers don't. The other officers. Again, it gets back to systemic. You know, they're carrying out. Systemic. In fact, one of the reasons they talk about community policing and all that is because, you know, they know they have a bad reputation, so they're trying to make it more palatable. And it's really aimed at people like me and you or middle-class folks who they figure could will see things from their perspective a little bit more. But it's literally not about perspective. It's about what they do. And I see it. I've been around, and I see it. The vast majority of police, I mean, because here's the other piece about the police thing. Is that they're locking people up. They're saying harmless stuff. That police are locking people up. Even so-called good people, they are locking people up. And they're locking folks up sometimes who don't need to be locked up. And they're locking folks up because they're concentrating in just a certain area. They're only locking people up in certain areas. The other thing, even the better ones, they're locking people up. So that's just our jails being filled by these people. All good, bad, or whatever. They're still locking folks up. Sometimes they don't have to lock up. And sometimes people who, if they weren't watching them so hard, they would lock them up. If they would they went into the Minneapolis, in our area, Edina, and Plymouth, and Minnetonka, the nice parts of the area, right, suburbs. So if they hung out in Minnetonka, just hung out on these blocks, watching kids, that they could rest the boat once that. Because they'd be smoking a lot of jokes. Come in the suburbs, right? If they watched them like they watched our folks. Well, they're locking them up, and they don't come to them. They don't go to the police are chilling. They ain't trying to find people to do wrong. These people are actively trying to catch you doing wrong. That's why they stop you with a broken taillight. Big deal. It's a broken taillight. You can go get that fixed. You know what I'm saying? Something hanging in the mirror. Those aren't crimes. Those aren't issues. They're stopping you because
like
they're looking
for
a way to lock you up.
I have a broken taillight. Thank you for letting me know I have a broken taillight, officer. No, I'm not expecting an officer. to turn on me because I have a broken taillight. I thought you were stopping me to help me, not stop me to hurt me.
No, they stopped you, right. They're looking for a reason. See, the difference is, this is where we have to be honest. That's the other thing we have to do. We have to take an honest, you know, I'm always saying to my when I'm right. We have to take an honest assessment. Look at things clearly in the eye. The old folks, you say, look at stuff clearly in the eye and make an honest assessment. If we're honest, you know that what's really going on is these people are purposely trying to do us in. That's what the that's the main role of the police. When we get right back to it, yes, they, some of them they're going to do some community police, but at the end of the day, the vast majority are pretty much looking for us to do something. In fact, sometimes trying to entrap you to doing stuff wrong. What's that about? Because it serves the ideology of white supremacy, and it serves the purposes of capitalism. So again, because we've gotten way too far away from the systemic thing, and this is up about you. Well, all people understand that there are stopgap things, but you have to understand that at the end of the day, our problem is the system. Malcolm X made it clear. Martin King lost his life because he was making it clear. Everybody who knows that's made it clear. People ignore them, or people start listening, folks talk them off. So when people start listening to me, I won't be available for this show, Verona.
I know.
You know,
I know.
When they really start listening, taking me seriously, they're going to lock me up, too. I'll start in an illusion because they know I'm telling the truth. They know that I'm telling the truth.
Yeah.
That's why they don't mess with me right now, because they don't want anybody paying attention. That's why they don't mess with me right now. But, you know what I'm saying? Because they don't want this. They don't, you know what I'm saying? They don't want people to know that. Yeah, they're scared of me. I get to get away with saying stuff and doing stuff in the community. You know, I intervene all the time. Police keep doing stuff. I intervene.
You don't really get away with saying stuff. I think you say it, and it's either education or historical perspective or spurs more conversation. And we're going to have to hold that more conversation until next week. Mel, I want to thank you for coming on my show, and I hope you always come on the show to enlighten us and tell us about what's going on in the community from the ground. And I applaud your bravery. I really do applaud you all the time when you're posting and you're really writing from the heart. I really applaud you. And we got some work to do in our community, but we also have some work to do with external factors that work in our community, and we need our Department of Justice to review and look at those pieces and say, we need help. Because the world is looking at us. It's not only here in the U.S. We have that image across the waters, all across the world and globally. So thank you, Mel, for joining me tonight on Cultural Conversations. We're going to come back next week and continue to talk about this topic. Thank you so much, Mel, for joining me.
Thank you. And you know, everybody else be easy and appreciate the conversation.
This is Verona Mitchell, and thank you for joining me on Cultural Conversations. At Cultural Conversations, we're bringing weekly cultural issues and topics to our online studio. Join me next week as we bring more of Cultural Conversations. Thank you for joining me. See you next week.